Okay, I want to get back into preparing your kids for the real world. I think this is number 4, if I remember right. And I didn't quite finish up last week the physical development aspect of child rearing, so I want to finish that up today. And we might get into just the very beginning of the spiritual development section. I'm not sure. We'll see how far along we get. This is the third point under the physical development aspect, and that is teaching your kids to be active. And if you've looked around, you can probably see in the last generation or so that there are a lot of inactive children out there, and this is important. And let me I just want to preface some things that I'm going to say today, and I've done this earlier in this study, but based on your exhortation, I want to make sure you understand that there are certain things that I'm teaching here that are my opinion based on either my own experience or observation or things that I've learned from others or something. And when they're my opinion, and I'm not always going to tell you this is my opinion. I guess you can figure it out. If there's a verse after it, it's not my opinion, you know, or if it's based on a verse I just read or something, some extrapolation. But if it's clearly an opinion, if I'm talking about how many hours a day you should spend on your video games, that's an opinion, obviously. The scripture doesn't give us specifics on that. So, but I would encourage you, like Jason just did, to at least hear me out and consider what I have to say. So anyway, teaching your kids to be active. If you've noticed, child obesity has increased dramatically over the last 40 years. And that's probably due to two main things. Can anybody think of two things that have increased childhood obesity in the last 40 years or so?
Computers.
Computers, or before that, TV, right? TV and fast food, I would say. When you get the combination of TVs and now computers and phones and all that and fast food, that's a recipe for obesity, right? Because if you're not doing as much and then you're eating horrible stuff, then it's going to cause you to gain weight. And now it's even worse with the smartphones and the iPads, because now you got it pretty much everywhere you go. You can sit on your butt and do nothing because you got your thing right in your pocket with you. I just want to read you a quote. This is from an article on the American Heart Association website. It's called Overweight in Children. And I thought this was pretty telling and quite frankly, alarming and concerning. It says, today, about 1 in 3 American kids and teens is overweight or obese. The prevalence of obesity in children more than tripled from 1971 to 2011. With good reason, childhood obesity is now the number one health concern among parents in the United States, topping drug use and smoking. That's something to think about. Most parents they're concerned that their kids might grow up and start smoking or especially start doing drugs, which could be very harmful to their health. But I don't think probably as many people are worried about their kids growing up to be obese and the health effects that could have on them. It says, among children today, obesity is causing a broad range of health problems that previously weren't seen until adulthood. These include high blood pressure, type 2 diabetes, and elevated blood cholesterol levels. There are also psychological effects. Obese children are more prone to low self-esteem, negative body image, and depression. And as far as I know, and I am certainly no expert on this at all, but I would think high blood pressure and type 2 diabetes were probably unheard of in children prior to 50 years ago. I don't think that was probably ever a thing, or if it was a rare, rare case, and now it's happening a lot. It says, an excess weight is associated with earlier risk of obesity-related disease and death in adulthood. Perhaps one of the most sobering statements regarding the severity of the childhood obesity epidemic came from former Surgeon General Richard Carmona, who characterized the threat as follows. Because of the increasing rates of obesity, unhealthy eating habits, and physical inactivity, we may see the first generation that will be less healthy and have a shorter life expectancy than their parents. Think about that. And I bet you he's right. Because just think about where we are now, and especially just even in the last generation or so, and then consider adding on to that 50 or 60 years until these kids now get to be, you know, in later adulthood. I don't know, it's not looking well, not looking good. The article continues, the prevalence of obesity, and then they define obesity apparently here by the BMI for age values at or above 95th percentile. BMI is body mass index, so basically how much fat your body has on it. And I guess they consider obesity apparently, if you are in the 95th percentile, then you're considered obese, I guess. It says anyway, the prevalence of obesity of the 2000 CDC growth charts in children ages 2 to 5, just little wee kids, increased from 4.8% in 1971 to 74 to 12.1% in 2009 to 2010. That's about almost a threefold increase from 40 years ago till roughly today, till about 7-8 years ago. For 6 to 11 year old children, the prevalence of obesity increased from 4% in 70 to 74 to 18% in 2009 and 10. Now that's over a fourfold increase in that age range, 6 to 11. The prevalence of overweight in adolescents ages 12 to 19 increased from 6.1% to 18.4%, about a threefold increase, a little more than a threefold increase again. So this is a real thing, and it's a real concern, and I think it merits me spending a little bit of time here in a sermon on it, because, well, if you don't hear it from me, maybe you won't hear it. Maybe you will hear it, but I don't think there's any subject that should be untouchable from the pulpit, especially if the Bible has anything to say about it. This, of course, is due to terrible eating habits. The fast food thing is a big thing, but then just the processed foods and just all the junk you buy in the grocery store can't certainly be helping out any. Just a good rule of thumb when you go to the grocery store, just a little personal observation, if you just stay out of the aisles and just walk around the outside and just only buy things, basically only buy things to your right. So walk counterclockwise around the store and buy things on your right hand, and you'll be a lot healthier than if you buy things on your left. It's interesting. This just totally came to mind. It says a fool's heart is at his left hand and a wise man's at his right. So think about that. You got to walk counterclockwise, though, because all the good stuff is on the outside. Think about it. The produce is on the right side, right? Then you get back, the meats are on the back, right, on the back wall, and then the milks, and then the cheeses or whatever, yogurts and things on the left. I guess it depends what grocery store you go to. But all the good stuff is on the outside. When you walk through the aisles, that's where you get all the processed junk. And anything you find in a box, it has more than 5 ingredients, and especially if you can't pronounce them without a bachelor's degree in some type of biology, then, or chemistry, then you probably shouldn't eat it, I suppose. So anyway, that's just a side note. Of course, this is also due to inactivity, which is facilitated by TV, video games, computers, tablets, smartphones. That's not doing anybody any favors. You see, kids were not made to watch TV or to play video games. They were rather made to play outside and to help with chores around the house. And I just have one little verse here. I just think this is interesting. If you turn back to Zechariah 8 and verse 5, and this verse will show you that this thing has been going on for thousands of years. But if you think about it, this is what kids have always done, right? Up until 50 years ago, I guess the invention of the TV probably, maybe the radio a little bit before that, but probably the TV. Kids played outside, right? That's what else did they do? When they helped with chores around the house and they worked. But they weren't inside sitting on their butts for probably any length of time, maybe playing with little toys or something. But this phenomenon of kids being just hours in front of a screen, that's never happened before. In Zechariah 8 and verse 5, I think this is interesting. It just shows you human nature has never changed. This is thousands of years ago, and kids were doing the same thing back then. I would say that they were doing today, but that they were doing 50 years ago, we'll say anyway, because they don't do so much of this today. It says, "And the streets of the city shall be full of boys and girls playing video games." That's not what it says, is it? "And the streets of the city shall be full of boys and girls playing on their iPhones." Doesn't say that either, does it? Let's see what it really says. "And the streets of the city shall be full of boys and girls playing in the streets thereof." And I just think it's kind of neat. And this is a promise of what's going to happen to Israel when they're, I believe, if I remember right, when they're restored back to the land, and then they're going to get back to normal, basically, where their kids are not going to be in deprivation anymore. It's just interesting. Boys and girls playing in the streets. This has been going on forever. And the sad thing is, today, you're half afraid to let your boys and girls go out and play in the streets. Right. Not because they'll get hit by a car, but because they'll get picked up by some sicko or something. It's horrible, and it's just terrible it has to be that way. I used to think parents were overreacting about that kind of stuff. I don't think they're overreacting about it anymore. I think it's a different world than it was a couple of generations ago. There might have been, you know, one or two sickos out of 1,000. It seems like there's a lot more sickos nowadays. And maybe that's because of the prevalence of online pornography and you just have to have more and more weirder and sicker stuff. I don't know. But anyway, I think there's a it is wise to keep a real close eye on your kids these days. But previous generations, they didn't have to deal with childhood obesity because the kids weren't raised on TV, video games, and the internet, or fast food for that matter. Now, it's true that bodily exercise is not nearly as important as spiritual exercise, right, as practicing godliness, but there is something to be said for bodily exercise. If you turn in 1 Timothy 4 and verse 8, I just want you to notice the wording here. Now, I don't like bodily exercise. I like working, and I'm telling you, I am so sore now because all week we worked. We painted for 2 days and then moved and all that, and it was a lot of work, and I just felt like I got run over by a freight train after the first day of it. But anyway, I like working hard. I don't like exercising, so I kind of wish that this verse said, "For bodily exercise profiteth nothing." And then that would make me feel a little better about myself. But it doesn't say that. It says, "For bodily exercise profiteth little, but godliness is profitable unto all things, having promise of the life that now is, and of that which is to come." So it doesn't say it doesn't profit at all. It profits little. And it profits little in comparison with godliness. So when you look at practicing godliness and bodily exercise is way down, or maybe, I guess if it's a scale, bodily exercise is way up here and godliness is way down here because it's more important, it's more weighty. But it still does profit something. Now, it's interesting that in these days, bodily exercise was not nearly as necessary as it is today, because in Timothy's day, when Timothy wasn't sitting there studying the word, he was probably out chopping firewood, he was out maybe working in his garden, he was out hunting animals, I don't know what he was doing. Anyway, he was doing something, he was doing physical labor, no doubt. He wasn't sitting there and ordering stuff off of Amazon every time he needed something, have it delivered to the house. So he was getting a lot more bodily exercise than I am. So this is important for me too. I need to get the bodily exercise. I do try to walk a little over a mile a day, and that's something. It's probably not enough, but it's at least something. But I've gotten enough exercise for the last week that I'm good for the next 2018. I don't have to do anything because I got enough in the last week. But anyway, there is something to be said for it. So instead of letting your kids play video games or watch TV or play on a phone or a tablet, have them go play outside. And not only is it better for them, it's better for you, right? You get some sanity. The house gets quiet for a half an hour or however long. And this is how I grew up. We did have a Nintendo when I was little, maybe 6 or 8, or I don't remember. But that was, we just kind of fell off the video game bandwagon after the original Nintendo. And I never got the Super Nintendo or the 64 or any of the rest of the stuff. But anyway, I played my share of Nintendo when I was little, but we also lived in the country and we were out and about, and I sound like I'm old, but it was different in those days, at least growing up in the country, because we were out, gone, for hours, or all day, I mean, well into the evening, and we had dirt bikes and mini bikes, and who knows, it's just amazing my parents let us do that stuff, because we were out miles in the woods, nobody would have ever found us, you'd have a search team, and we'd have been rotten and stinking by the time the search team ever found us. It was just different back then, I guess, and my parents didn't have to worry as much, and nothing ever happened to us, thankfully. But in this day and age, I would say you definitely want to limit the time that your kids are spending on electronic devices, not only because of the childhood obesity thing, but it's not good for their minds. And if you remember the Digital Invasion series that I did, and I talked then about how the electronics, the digital media, it's messing with our brains, and it makes different connectors within your brain, and it makes you think differently. And I don't remember all the details from then, but I covered it in those sermons, and you might want to review them, so might I. If you can't control them, though, or if they cause you too much grief, I just say get rid of them. If you can control them and you can tell your kids, okay, a half an hour a day or whatever your standard is, and they don't give you a ton of grief about it and it's not making your life miserable, okay then. But I'd say if you can't control it and your kids are just unruly about it, say, you know what, we're just getting rid of it. We're not going to have it because it's too much grief in my life. Once again, so there's my opinion, okay? So I think you can pretty much figure out when my opinion comes into things. Now, here's definitely my opinion. I personally would not allow TV or video games in our home. Now, I'm just going to kind of reemphasize what Jason said. And don't answer the question. You don't even need to nod your head because I don't want to know what you think. But I'm just going to ask you a question. Do you consider me a wise person or not? Don't give me any feedback. You don't have to tell me. If you consider me a wise person, and maybe you don't, and that's okay, but if you consider me a wise person, then you should at least consider what I'm saying here and think, well, if this is my personal opinion, there must be some reason why I've come to this opinion, and I just didn't just randomly, arbitrarily just wake up one day and just say, no TV in my house, no reason whatsoever. I have reasons for this. I personally would not allow it. And I got off of TV back in 2005, I think. So it's been a long time, almost 13 years ago. And I was amazed back then, and I'm sure it's worse now. And I literally hardly ever see TV. I don't hardly ever see any commercials. A lot of times when people talk about commercials or shows, I don't even know what they're talking about. I noticed after I got off of TV, and I'm talking about it like it was almost a drug or something, but once I got off of TV for a couple of years, and I was kind of cold turkey for a while, then whenever I would see television, and especially the commercials, I was aghast. I just couldn't believe what I was seeing with the filth and the garbage on it. I was just shocked. And I think you'll find out that you have been, if you watch TV, you have been so desensitized to all that crap on there, you don't even realize it. It's like people that live in Las Vegas and they drive around. When I went to Las Vegas the first time, I was just shocked at the billboards and all this crazy stuff. I was telling Conrad and Marydale about it, and they were just like, I mean, they recognize it, but I don't think it's just not, they see it so often, it's not a big deal anymore. It's the same thing with TV. You would be amazed. Just don't see TV for maybe take a while, maybe a year. You'd be shocked, I think. So there's just so much garbage on there to pollute your mind and to waste your time, for that matter. I decided to get rid of it, and I've never gone back and never missed it. Video games, I think that those are also a waste of time, and I don't think that they're good for the kids based on what I've read there in that book, The Digital Invasion. Especially the younger the kids, the more damage it can do to you. Everything in moderation. I mean, I'm not saying that play video games once in a while is going to hurt you any more than to go to McDonald's once in a while is going to hurt you, but to do it excessively is definitely not a good idea, in my opinion. I would not allow my young children to play on computers or iPads or smartphones at all because of the developmental, social, and behavioral problems that they cause. And I'm not going to define what young means, but I mean, young, I don't know, probably under 6 or 8 years old or something. I don't exactly know. I haven't got this firm in my mind because I don't have kids yet, I guess. I don't have to get it down to the year. But I would not let my young children play on that stuff, especially little kids, like little toddlers and babies and things like that. That is not developmentally good for them at all. And the younger they are, the more damaging it can be to them. And I've read articles to this effect. Not to mention the cost of these things. Like an iPhone, for instance, I don't remember ever letting a young child ever even hold my iPhone. And I won't. It's like $600 or $700. Am I gonna hand a little kid a $600 or $700 piece of glass to let them smash? No way. I won't even let them touch it. But I don't, and what if I have kids and they're not gonna use it? And I know people, and this may sound extreme, but I do know people that do this very thing and have done it since their kids were born. And it can be done. I've seen it done. You just got to make up your mind if you want to do it or not. That's the thing. What I would do is I would explain to my kids the danger of these things and why I limit the use of them. And I would do it both before and after they're old enough to understand what I'm even talking about. Because, you know, you teach your kids things when they're little and they don't really understand, but you just tell them these things, and eventually when they get old enough, then they understand, and then maybe they remember all that reinforcement and it's better for them. And I would explain to them before and after. What you don't want to do, in my opinion, is just make a rule and say no video games, and the kid says, well, why? My friends have video games or something. And you just say, because I said so. That's not a good idea. Because they don't understand. And if you can explain to them, at least give them some kind of a reason, that's going to help them out a lot. Now, here's the thing. I would allow my kids to play video games for a short period of time at their cousin's house or at their friend's house or something when they go there. I don't think it wouldn't be good, in my opinion, to take your kids somewhere else and all their friends or somebody's playing video games and they have to sit there and not play, right? It's kind of like eating McDonald's. Am I going to take them to McDonald's regularly? No way. Once in a while for a snack? Sure. They go out with their friends? Sure. No problem. But I wouldn't, but they're not going to have them at our house, but I would let them be exposed to them at other people's house. And I might limit it a half an hour. You can play games with your friends for half an hour and then your friends can do whatever they want, but you can go outside or you can play, do something else. So anyway, playing video games is not a sin. So I'm not saying you can't do it. And that's why I said that I would allow my kids to do it, but I'm not going to have it in my own house. Just like I'd allow them to eat McDonald's, but I'm not going to bring it home every night for dinner, right? So you can look at that, listen to that series on the digital invasion and get a more full explanation of some of the dangers of the digital media, especially for kids. But if you think about it, this will prepare your kids for the real world. Responsible adults don't spend much time playing video games, watching too much TV, or playing on their phones too much. I'm not saying that responsible adults can never do these things, but they don't spend hours a day doing these kind of things, I don't think. As far as I'm aware, anyway. I don't know too many responsible adults that are spending hours and hours a day playing video games or those kind of things. Responsible adults have more important things to do rather than spending hours a day doing those kind of things. And I include being on the phone too much, too, because I've got a phone and I've got to struggle with putting that thing down, too. So I'm here with you, even if I don't have the video games and the TV. Okay, the next thing is to teach your kids to work hard. This is important for physical development, and this, of course, blends into spiritual development and mental development, because they're going to learn by working hard. It's not sheerly by building their muscles, but they're going to learn a good work ethic, and that's going to do them well for the rest of their lives, whether they're men or women. It doesn't matter. I will say, to the Quorum Kids' credit, you guys know how to work. You're good, hard workers, and I can see that by experience. Because they came over, James and Maddie came over on Monday and Tuesday and helped us paint our house. And they were there from early in the morning until late in the evening and then all day on Tuesday. And we worked really hard. We painted that whole house except for my office. And they were a huge help. And they worked really hard. And they, I mean, it was right at the end. They were getting kind of tired, a little weary. And I kept, I mean, I had that whip just cracking that thing. But they did a really, really good job. And then Friday to move, my goodness, that desk of mine, that thing is unbelievable, unbelievably heavy. And some of the other stuff. And anyway, they worked and they worked and they worked, and I could have never done it without them. So thank you guys. Thank you for your hard work. Kids used to know how to work. This is, once again, 50 years ago, the idea of kids just sitting around doing nothing until they're 22 and graduated college or something, that never happened, as far as I know anyway. Kids used to know how to work. They grew up working on the family farm or working in the family business. And this was before child labor laws. You know, they were wee little. I mean, they could help out in the family store or whatever on the farm, and that certainly didn't hurt the kids, and it was helpful to the family. But we don't have that today. Kids back then were taught, probably, I'll bet you, as soon as they could walk, they started working. They started doing something. I mean, a little two-year-old kid can gather up eggs, right, or something. I mean, back in those days, working was just life. It wasn't something you did whenever you got to be an adult. Working is just something that you do all the time. Not long ago, kids in their early teens would have got a part-time job at a local business in order to make their own money. That was just normal, right? And nowadays, they keep raising the working age to where they won't even allow kids legally to work. I don't know what the age is now. Is it 15 or something? I don't know what it is. But anyway, that used to be the norm. But today, many kids, they never get a job until they graduate from college. And that's if they can even find a job once they graduate from college. There's a lot of kids, and I don't know, maybe not a lot, but I don't know what the percentages are. But there are plenty of kids, I'm sure, growing up, especially in affluent neighborhoods and such, they probably have never worked a job a day in their life until they graduate college. They graduate college and that's their first job. And they're accustomed to having everything handed to them. That's no way to bring up kids. To teach them that until they're well into their adult life, that everything that you've never had to associate labor with money or labor with things. You just get everything handed to you, and that's no way to train up kids. Most kids never work, they never earn money, they've never bought anything that they own, and I don't think that is a healthy way to raise kids. There's a lot of definitions of what an adult is, and I'm just going to give you one. This is a short one, and this would not encompass everything, but I think this would be one necessary thing in order to become an adult and be considered an adult. Being an adult means working to provide for yourself, if I had to just sum it up in a sentence. And I would not consider somebody an adult, somebody, especially somebody that is progressing towards adulthood, I would not call a person an adult until you're working and providing for yourself. So your 18th birthday does not mean you're an adult. Your 18th birthday means nothing whatsoever, except that you happen to be 18 years old. You could be an adult at 16, or you might not be an adult until 30. It just all depends. So I'd say at what point you are self-sufficient, relying on nobody else for anything, at that point you are fully an adult. And before that, you're progressing into adulthood. Now, whether you agree with that definition or not is really immaterial, but that would be my definition of an adult. So therefore, teaching your kids to work and to work hard is absolutely essential to prepare your kids for the real world. So you don't want to send them out there having never worked before, and you're just sending them out to the wolves, right? You want to get them ready for the business world or whatever world they're going to be in. And when they go out there, they're going to know how to work 8 hours a day, and they're not going to be like these millennials that need a break after every 15 minutes they've worked, and they want to come in at 10 o'clock and leave at 3 or something. That's no way to prepare your kids for the real world. God expects us to work fervently at whatever we do. So let's get to some scripture here. I know I've done a lot of talking, and now I've got a whole bunch of verses for you. Look at Romans 12 and verse 11. Romans 12 and verse 11. God is just as concerned with how we go about our day-to-day lives out there digging ditches or whatever we're doing as he is with us studying the Bible and living good, moral, godly lives. He's just as concerned with how we work as he is with anything else that we do. Because he tells us to do our work as if we're doing it to him. We come in here to worship God, and we are worshiping him directly. When you go out there to your job, you are working for God directly. That's the way that God sees it. And I got verses that will prove that in just a second. Look at Romans chapter 12 and verse 11 first. Paul says he's giving all these short, little, pithy statements about basic, practical Christian duty. And one of the things he says is not slothful in business, fervent in spirit, serving the Lord. Not slothful. Slothful means, when we're speaking of persons, full of sloth, indisposed to exertion, inactive, indolent, lazy, or sluggish. I've said this before. I'm not sure if the sloth person is named after the sloth animal or vice versa. But when I mentioned that last time, pardon me, Judy Hatcher sent me a couple of videos about a sloth. One of them was in that little movie, I forget what it's called, about the little girl, the girl bunny police officer, Zootopia. And they go into the DMV to get some kind of information about a car. And it's sloths at the DMV. And she asks for a question, and the guy is speaking like every syllable about once every 5 seconds. And she's like, come on, come on, come on, I need to get it. Okay, I will do that. And she's just going crazy. And then she tells him a joke, and he laughs about 3 minutes later. And then he's got to repeat the joke to the other sloth. And then, oh, it was really funny. And just the idea of the DMV people being sloths in the movie was quite funny if you've ever been to government offices before. But then there was the Geico commercial. I think it was Geico. And they were playing Pictionary or something where you draw the thing. And the sloth is the one that's drawing the picture. And he's up there, and he's drawing this line like, you know, it takes up the whole minute, and he only draws one line. They're guessing all these things, and it's like, it's an apple or something. I don't know I forget what it was, but of course you couldn't guess it because he only got the stem drew or whatever the thing was. But anyway, that was quite funny. So not slothful in business. So not inactive or indolent or lazy in business. So when we work, and business doesn't necessarily mean commerce so much as it means just whatever you're doing, just do it with fervor. That's what he says, fervent in spirit. Fervent is hot, burning, glowing, boiling of persons, their passions, dispositions, or actions, ardent, intensely earnest. It says from the 17th century, almost exclusively with reference to love or zeal, or love or hatred, zeal, devotion, or aspiration. So instead of being lazy, God wants us to be on fire. So when you go to your job, just think about lighting a fire under yourself and getting you moving. My neighbor used to tell me this story about the old Indian wanted to get the little Indian moving, and the guy was laying in his teepee, not doing anything on his cot or something. So the old Indian went in there and he started a fire under the guy. And when the flames started hitting his butt, the guy got up and started to do something. He says, so the moral of the story is you got to light a fire under him. And I always remembered that from a kid. So think about that. Just light a fire under yourself when you're at work, and teach your kids to have a fire within them to be whatever they're doing, to do it with all their might. And that's what Solomon tells us to do in Ecclesiastes 9 and verse 10. Ecclesiastes 9 and verse 10. I don't think anybody likes a lazy person. I know I don't. I don't like it when I'm lazy myself, though there is a time for kicking back and relaxing once in a while, but I can relax much better once I've had a good day's work. The scripture says that the sleep of a laboring man is sweet. Let me tell you what, when you do physical work, which I'm not that accustomed to doing anymore since I mostly work at a desk, but this week, when I lay down, sleep is sweet. And I'm having crazy dreams probably because I'm in like this deep sleep, and that's whenever you start dreaming. So anyway, look at Ecclesiastes 9 and verse 10. It says, whatsoever thy hand findeth to do, do it with thy might. For there is no work, nor device, nor knowledge, nor wisdom in the grave whither thou goest. Jesus said he had to work while it was day. He said, the night cometh when no man can work. So work while it is today. Work hard as long as you can. And whatever you do, Solomon says, do it with all thy might. It doesn't matter how menial the task. Whatever you have to do, do it as if it was the most important thing you have to do, and do it as if God himself told you to do it. And that's easier said than done. I totally realize that. But just try to remember that and get in that mindset. And every time that you don't feel like doing something, remind yourself of these verses and say, do it under the Lord, and that'll be a motivation. It's not just physical labor, though, that is exhausting. In Ecclesiastes 12, Ecclesiastes 12:12, it says, and further by these, my son, be admonished, of making many books there is no end, and much study is a weariness, not of the mind, of the flesh. I'm sure you have, if you've been in high school or college, or if you have a desk job where you're doing a lot of mental exertion, you know, you'll feel like you're physically exhausted from that. It's your mind apparently takes a lot of your energy. I mean, most of your heat escapes out of your head. It's probably because that's your computer up there running like crazy. And whenever you're running that mind like crazy, it wears your body out. So just because I don't do a lot of physical work, I still do work, I still do labor, and all of you that sit in front of a desk do too. But you want to do it heartily, as unto the Lord, whatever you do. Look at Colossians 3 and verse 23. And of course, the point is you want to teach your kids to do this. And as I said in the outset of this sermon, there's going to be something in here for everybody, because this stuff here, I'm telling you to teach your kids, but I'm preaching it to everybody. We all ought to be doing these things, and then teaching it to your kids, the best way to do that is to do it yourself. Kids or anybody else don't pay much attention to hypocrites, right? If you tell your kids to do something, but you're not doing it yourself, they're going to see that your conduct doesn't match your creed, and it's not going to be very effective. It's like the guy that's sitting there and he's totally sloshed telling his kids don't you ever drink alcohol, you know. That's going to fall on deaf ears. Colossians 3 and verse 23 says, and whatsoever you do, do it heartily as to the Lord and not unto men. Look at that word there, the second word. Whatsoever. That means anything, whatever you do, if you're out there mowing the grass, or if you're unclogging the toilet, or if you're doing just a menial, repetitive, mind-numbing job, whatever you're doing, do it heartily, as unto the Lord. Heartily, as in with all your heart. Put yourself into that and do it as hard as you can. Look at Ephesians 6 and verse 7. Paul is giving instructions here to servants. And he says, I'll start in verse 6, "Not with eye service as men pleasers, but as the servants of Christ, doing the will of God from the heart, with good will, doing service as to the Lord and not to men." He's talking here to people that were servants, could be slaves. And he's telling them, the slaves, you do this work not as unto your master, but as unto your master in heaven, as unto the Lord. Now, this will benefit your kids. It'll benefit you. Because people that are diligent in their works will go far. In their work will go far. Let me take you to a verse that shows us that in Proverbs 22 and verse 29. Proverbs 22:29. Then I'm going to embarrass somebody and give you an example of it. I'm going to embarrass you in a good way, though. Not in a bad way. I'd never embarrass you in a bad way publicly. Proverbs 22 and verse 19. 29, thank you. It says, "Seest thou a man diligent in his business? He shall stand before kings. He shall not stand before mean men." Mean meaning base or average, just some dolt. He's not going to stand with those guys. He's going to stand before kings. And I'll give you our brother Chris as an example. Chris went to work at Culver's here a couple years ago or so. I don't remember exactly when it was. Just started out, you know, just working the counter or whatever. And Chris is diligent in his business. And before you know it, he's promoted to assistant manager, manager. Promoted to manager there at the store within just a couple year or so. And he's only 18, 19 years old, I think, at the time. Why did they promote him to manager? Because he was diligent in his business. He probably wasn't like some of the other employees that they've had that were goofing around, and any time that they didn't have a customer, they were on their phone or whatever they were doing. He was diligent in his business. And he's not standing before kings just yet, but you keep being diligent in your business, who knows? I mean, you may be standing before kings someday. The point is that you'll go far if you're diligent. Because employers like to see the hustler. They like to see the hard worker. And whenever they see that, and they see a guy that's diligent, and you give him a task, any task, and he goes at that thing with fervor, and he completes it, they like to see that, and they will promote that guy. Usually. You know what sometimes unfortunately happens, though? It's like corporate America is like a cesspool. The biggest turds float to the top. Sometimes, in these crazy environments, they get a guy that's horrible, And whoever his boss is doesn't have enough guts to fire him, so he promotes him instead just to get rid of him. You ever see this happen? This especially happens in government work. It's horrible. So the guys that are just the worst end up going to the top. And then the guys that are really diligent at what they do, they don't want to lose them doing that thing that they're so good at, and they don't promote them. But the Bible says you'll stand before kings. So just go with it, and eventually it'll work out for you. I do trust. You want to teach your kids to have a mind to work. This is what Nehemiah and the Jews did when they went back to the land to rebuild. In Nehemiah 4 and verse 6, they accomplished something that, quite frankly, would have been something to accomplish in those days. I mean, they rebuilt that big wall around Jerusalem. They rebuilt the temple. They did all that stuff. And the reason was because they had a mind to work. They had put their mind to it, that they were going to make this thing work, that they were going to work against all odds, because they had enemies, actual enemies. They worked with a trow in one hand and with a sword in the other, it says. So they worked in perilous conditions, but they completed the work because they put their minds to it. Nehemiah 4 and verse 6. Nehemiah says, "So we built the wall, and the wall was joined together under the half thereof, for the people had a mind to work." Now, if they would have just been lackadaisical and lazy and be like, oh, I don't want to build this wall. Who really cares? Let's just go back to Babylon. They had a big wall there. That was a nice place. They wouldn't have got the thing finished. But they had a mind to work. That's why you want to instill this in your kids when they're little. Teach them the value of hard work and teach them to work hard. And when they have the mindset of hard work and a good work ethic, it will carry them through the rest of their lives and it'll take them far. You want to teach your kids to be like the ants who work hard when they can to save money, or in the ants' case, to save up food for when they can't work hard. Look at Proverbs 6:6-11. Proverbs 6:6-11. I am sorry to say, but there are a lot of Americans that apparently have smaller brains than ants. Because, and I don't know how big an ant's brain is, but an ant isn't very big. His brain can't be bigger than a pinhead. Have you ever heard somebody call it a pinhead? I mean, an ant probably has the brain of a pinhead. And a lot of Americans can't figure out what the ant figured out, and that is to lay up in the summertime because the winter comes and you can't work anymore. It's called saving money for retirement, and I don't think many people have figured that out. Proverbs 6:6-11 says, go to the ant, thou sluggard, consider her ways and be wise, which having no guide, overseer, or ruler, provideth her meat in the summer and gathereth her food in the harvest. The ant doesn't have anybody telling him to gather up during the summertime and lay up. Gather up in the harvest and lay up for the time to come. God's put that, he's programmed that into that little ant. And God says, look at the ant. Even if you had no Bible, if you had no instructors, no teachers, even if you couldn't read, you could literally look at the little ants, and if you have a rational mind, you could say, huh, those little guys are smart. They're out there working like crazy, and then they're laying it up so they have something to eat all winter long. The bees. Go to the bee, thou sluggard. The bee goes out there and works like crazy. For the whole 36 days of the poor little guy's life, he works his little wings to the bone, and then he dies. I think it's 36 days later. And lays up all that honey for somebody else to eat. That's what he does. Bees are fascinating. But anyway, we can figure things out. Look at the little squirrels. You see the squirrels running around? I've never seen a squirrel stand still for more than about 2 seconds. He's constantly running around. And what's he doing? He's getting food, right? He's laying up that food in his nest or in his belly or whatever. We can learn from these guys. Let's keep reading. How long wilt thou sleep, O sluggard? When wilt thou arise out of thy sleep? Yet a little sleep, a little slumber, a little folding of the hands to sleep. So shall thy poverty come as one that traveleth, and thy want as an armed man. You see, if you don't act like the ant, then your want or your need is going to come like an armed man. You are going to be in some serious trouble. Now the problem is, we don't have a direct correlation between working and eating in this society anymore. We have the government in between working and eating, and we have the government in between working and retirement. And so people just don't know, oh, I don't, what do I have to save for retirement? The government's there, Social Security or disability or something's going to be there for me in the future. I don't have to worry about it. The problem is, it's probably not going to be there for most of us. By the time we get there, it's not going to be there. So it may have worked for previous generations. It may work for a current generation. Who knows when the crash will come, but it's not always going to work. We're going to get back to the old model of working to eat, working to save up for your own retirement, providing for yourself in your latter years, not relying on the government to do it for you. You might rely on your family, but I'll bet you your family, if they know, if your kids know that they're going to be funding your retirement, they're probably going to light a fire under you to start funding your own. I know I would. If my parents are going to tell me that, hey, I'm just going to lounge around and do nothing and I'm going to live off of you when I get old, I'm going to say, no, you better get to work or you're not going to live off of me when you get old. You want to teach your kids that laziness is wickedness in God's eyes. I don't think we fully appreciate how much God hates laziness. We just look at laziness as like, oh, you know, it's not such a big deal. I mean, at least I'm not an adulterer, you know. At least I'm not a drunk. You know, at least I never killed anybody. You know, I never stole anything or never got caught for it anyway. You know, I never done any of the real bad things, right? But God considers laziness as wickedness. Look in Matthew 25, 26. You want to teach your kids this. Tell your kids, whenever you see them being lazy, and no doubt they will be, because that's we all have to learn a good work ethic. Most of us aren't born with it. When you see them being lazy, then remind them of this parable and remind them of the blessing that the guy that took the 2 talents and the 5 talents and what they did with them and how they were blessed by God. Remind them of that. And then remind them of the guy that took the talent and did nothing with it and he was lazy. And the Lord condemned that man. He was very unhappy with him. Matthew 25, I'm in Luke. Matthew 25 and verse 26. It says, "His Lord answered and said unto him, Thou wicked and slothful servant, thou knewest that I reap where I sowed not, and gather where I have not strawed. Thou oughtest therefore have put my money to the exchangers, and then at my coming I should have received mine own with usury. Take therefore the talent from him, and give it unto him that hath 10 talents. This guy hid the talent in the earth. And you think, well, at least he didn't blow it. At least he didn't steal or squander it. But you know what? God was not happy that he didn't do anything with the talent. It's not like he did something bad with the talent. He just didn't do anything with the talent. He was lazy. And he says he was afraid. He says, "I was afraid, and I went and hid thy talent in the earth. Lo, here thou hast that is thine." But you know what he really was? He was lazy. And he was using fear as an excuse for laziness. And the master sees what's really going on there. The master didn't say, "Thou afraid servant, thou fearful servant." He didn't say that. He said, "Thou wicked and slothful servant." The master saw that the fear was only an excuse for the laziness. And he calls him a wicked servant. And this is a parable of the kingdom of heaven. This is a parable of God giving talents unto his children to be used for him. And God here is calling this man that was lazy, he's calling him a wicked man. You want to teach your kids that laziness leads to poverty. And you might even teach them this by, I don't know, I mean by some creative, if they're starting to be lazy, then you say, "You got to work a certain amount before I give you a candy bar," or something like that, or something like that. And then they'll start to understand when they don't get the candy, and their brothers did, and you say, "The reason you didn't get that is because you didn't work. You didn't do whatever you were supposed to do." And then they start to associate, oh, work with benefit, or work with food, or whatever. So you might want to get creative and do something like that. Proverbs 13 and verse 4. Proverbs 13 and verse 4. It says, "The soul of the sluggard desireth and hath nothing, but the soul of the diligent shall be made fat." He's going to be made fat as he's sitting before kings. Remember, the diligent man will be before kings, and he's going to be made fat. Now, the sluggard, he's going to desire all the stuff that the diligent guy had, but guess what? He's going to have nothing because the government wasn't there to give it to him. He had to actually work and labor to get it if he wanted it. It says in another place, the sluggard is so lazy that he won't even bring his hand to his mouth to feed himself. Now, that's pretty lazy. I've never actually met somebody that lazy, but I suppose there could be somebody out there. Look at Proverbs 24, 30 through 34. Especially if you're a homeowner, laziness will bring you to poverty because and I'm going to learn all about this here now. If you don't keep up your house, it will fall down. And it does say, the Bible actually says that. "By much slothfulness, the house droppeth through," it says. I don't know if I have that verse for you in the outline or not, but it does say that. So if you don't keep the house up, it'll fall down. And especially if you don't keep certain things up, like the roof, right? You got a hole in your roof and you say, "I don't feel like fixing that." Well, you're going to be fixing the walls and the foundation. You're going to be fixing a whole bunch of stuff. Proverbs 24, 30 through 34. "I went by the field of the slothful and by the vineyard of the man void of understanding." You see, the slothful man, the scripture says, is stupid. He's lazy. Well, why is he so lazy? Maybe he's not smart enough to figure out, if I don't work, I'm going to be poor. You know, you're not very smart if you can't figure that out. "And lo, it was all grown over with thorns, and nettles had covered the face thereof, and the stone wall thereof was broken down. Then I saw and considered it well. I looked upon it and received instruction. Get a little sleep, a little slumber, a little folding of the hands to sleep, so shall thy poverty come as one that traveleth, in thy want as an armed man. Solomon sees the lazy guy that's not doing anything, and he sees his hedge is all broken down, and he's got thorns and nettles all over the place. The place looks like a dump. And he says, I looked at that, I considered it, and I learned from it. This guy was doing too much napping and not enough working, and he came to poverty. And you want to teach your kids that. And if you teach your kids a strong work ethic, I would say that's far more important than teaching them even a trade or getting them a degree or anything like that, because that strong work ethic, even if they don't have any of the education, will take them further than the lazy guy with the education. Now, if you get a strong work ethic and a good education, you got good skills, that's even better. But if you had to pick one or the other, the strong work ethic will take you much further every time. You want to teach your kids that nobody's going to want to hire them if they're lazy. Because if you were an employer, and I don't think any of us in here are, but if you were an employer, if I was an employer, I would not want to hire somebody that's lazy. I could deal with somebody that was slightly incompetent. I could deal with somebody that, you know, a little bit flighty and they forget about stuff and break things or lose things once in a while. I could deal with all that stuff. But a lazy guy, he's going to go. I cannot handle that kind of thing. Proverbs 10 and verse 26. Proverbs 10 and verse 26. It says, as vinegar to the teeth. You ever drink vinegar before? Especially white vinegar? Pretty pungent, right? It's pretty repulsive. It doesn't taste the greatest. As vinegar to the teeth and as smoke to the eyes. You ever stand next to a campfire and get a bunch of smoke in your eyes? Doesn't feel very good, right? It's an irritant, right? As vinegar to the teeth and as smoke to the eyes, so is the sluggard to them that send him. It's an irritating experience. You send a lazy guy to get something done, and it's as if you just drank a glass full of vinegar and stuck your head in a furnace and got smoke in your eyes. It's irritating. You may as well just go do it yourself. Nobody's going to want to hire somebody that's lazy. So you want to teach your kids that. You want to teach your kids to work in unpleasant conditions. Because, let's face it, I mean, there's... all of us are cut out for different jobs, and some of us are probably going to have some not the greatest jobs, and we might have to work outside, or we might have to work in the mud, or in inclement weather, or bad shifts, or whatever. So you want to teach your kids to work in unpleasant conditions. You want to push their limits just a little bit. Look in Proverbs 20 and verse 4. You don't want to push them too far. You don't want to, especially the younger they are. I mean, they can't handle too much. But you always want to take them to maybe write about what they can handle and then push them just a little bit further and just make them understand the value of just pushing forward and just finishing that thing. Like when we were painting on Monday, I wasn't going to let you guys go until we got the living room and the kitchen done. I thought, I'm not leaving this house until these things are done. And we pushed through and we got it done. And I'm sure you guys probably wanted to go home earlier than that. And I wanted to go home earlier than that. But we were going to get it done. Proverbs 20 and verse 4 says, the sluggard will not plow by reason of the cold. Therefore shall he beg and harvest and have nothing. Oh, it's too cold out there. I can't plow. Oh, the ground might be frozen. I can't get out there and plow. And guess what? Maybe the next day it's raining. Oh, I can't plow because it's raining. And then the next day something comes up. And before you know it, it's June. It's July. You haven't plowed. And guess what? Come September, October, your corn's about 2 feet high, and there's no ears on there. And now what are you going to do for the wintertime? You're not going to have anything. Now, of course, this is back before grocery stores and so on, but you get the point, right? The sluggard won't plow by reason of the cold. Therefore, when harvest comes, he's going to have nothing. And I'll tell you what. I've told you this story before. Hopefully, you've forgotten about it because it's one of my favorites, so I'll tell you again. And if you've heard it already, then you'll hear it again. It's important to memorize Scripture because then the Scripture can admonish you and exhort you about things. And I remember one time I had this little Ford Escort, and I drove it home through a blizzard, and it was missing really badly. It was only a four-cylinder, so if you're missing on one cylinder, you're not doing very well. And it's just the engine sounds like a diesel or something. And by the time I got home, I just went in the house, and I thought, whatever, I don't care. I'm just going to drive it until it blows up. It was old. I just thought, I'm done. I don't know what the problem is. And I didn't have a garage at the house. I just didn't feel like looking at it. And I went in and I sat down and I just thought about that verse. The sluggard will not plow by reason of the cold, therefore shall he beg and harvest and have nothing. And I got my coat back on and I went back outside and I traipsed through all the snow, opened the hood, and all it was the little clip that holds the spark plug wire in place had popped off. And the spark plug wire was laying on the exhaust manifold. It melted through it, and the spark plug wire was just short into the exhaust manifold, and it was missing on that cylinder. I literally just had to pick it back up, stick the little connector in the slot, and it ran fine. If I would have kept driving that thing, I would have, I don't know, blown something up. There would have been something, the distributor or something would have been damaged, and it would have been a lot more work. So anyway, that's a good example of that verse right there. Traipse through the snow, through the cold, do the work you've got to do, and it'll save you a whole lot of time in the future. And God won't be irritated with you because you were just too lazy to do whatever needed to be done, even if the weather was bad. And you want to teach your kids not to make excuses for their laziness. Look at Proverbs 22 and verse 13. Because you ever notice, you ever talk to lazy people? They've always got lots of excuses. They've always got tons of reasons why they didn't get something done. You ever notice that? It's interesting. If I learned this from Pastor Mott years ago. If you want to get something done, if you need to have somebody's help getting something done, ask a busy person. You'd think you'd ask the person that's got nothing going on. But guess what? If they got nothing going on, it's probably because they never do anything. And if you ask them to help you out and they never do anything, chances are nothing's going to get done. But you think, well, I don't want to ask a busy person, they're busy. Well, you know what? They're busy because they get a lot of stuff done. You ask a busy person and they'll fit it in somewhere. You ask the guy that's not busy, he probably will never fit it in. Because he's got, you know, too much on his plate doing nothing to do something. Proverbs 22 and verse 13. Says, the slothful man saith, there is a lion without, I shall be slain in the streets. You see, he's got a reason. He's lazy. I can't go out and work. There's lions out there, for goodness sakes. I could get tore up. I could lose my life. I can't go outside. And everybody's got their own lion, right? Why didn't you get that report put in? Well, because I was afraid of this or that, or who knows what. I didn't know what you wanted me to say. I thought maybe I'd say the wrong thing and you'd be mad at me or whatever. I mean, there's always something. There's always some excuse. You don't want to accept your children's excuses. You want to teach your kids to focus their efforts on working instead of coming up with reasons why they shouldn't. You ever notice that about a lazy person? They will go to great lengths to not work. They will put in more effort to figure out a way not to do the job than they would have if they would have just done the job. I'm sure you've seen this before. I mean, lazy people are incredibly innovative and inventive of finding reasons to not do whatever needs to be done. Look at Proverbs 26 and verse 16. And my dad always says this, and every time I carry in a big load of groceries from the car and I'm killing myself to do it, I think of what my dad says, a lazy man would rather break his back than make two trips. And I think about that as I'm carrying in 14 bags of groceries and I'm trying to fuddle them around to get the door unlocked and dropping things and irritated and just think, stupid, it would have been easier just to make two trips. Proverbs 26 and verse 16. The sluggard is wiser in his own conceit than seven men that can render a reason. Oh yeah, you got seven men that can give a good reason why he should do something, but he's wiser than all of them. He's always got a better idea of why he shouldn't be doing something. Of course, with this stuff and with everything in this series, you want to lead by example. You want to show your kids how to work hard by doing it yourself. So whenever you're doing work around the house, whatever it might be, have your kids help you out with it. And then they'll learn how to do things. I think the mistake a lot of parents make, and I'm sure it's easy to do so, is that you don't want to take the time to teach your kids to do whatever you're doing because it's extra time, right? If you're fixing the toilet, it's just faster for you to fix it yourself than it is for you to get your young child in there and show him what you're doing and have him do it, and then maybe he messes it up or he breaks something and it takes you an hour when it should have taken you 15 minutes. But I would encourage you to take the time and to have your kids help you out with things. I'll give you an example. My dad taught me a lot of things, knowing how to work on cars and all that kind of thing. I learned all that stuff from my dad. But one thing he never taught me to do, and I think it was probably just because every time we were doing it, he was just too busy to take the time to teach me. He never taught me how to weld. I wish I knew how to weld. And I don't know if any of you know how to weld, and if what I'm telling you probably won't really make any sense to you if you don't. But when I weld, here's what it goes like. Chunk. Rip the thing off. Chunk. It just sticks right fast, and I can't make the thing work. Or else it's just a bunch of little beads that you could pretty much scrape off with your finger once you get done welding them on there. They never gets deep enough, and the heat never penetrates, right? Because it either sticks or you get too far away and it burns. Anyway, I never learned how to weld. And I wish my dad would have taught me how to weld. But once again, every time when we're welding, it's because something's broke, it needs to be fixed, we don't have time, whatever. So that's just an example. So take the time to teach your kids to do whatever you know how to do. And if you're learning to do something new, then teach them how to do it along with you. And then they'll know how to do things whenever they get older. Now, if they don't want to naturally follow your example, then you want to make them do so. So sometimes they're going to naturally follow you, and sometimes they're going to need a little bit of encouragement to follow you. You might want to give them some incentives to work hard by paying them to do jobs around the house, and get this, that are in addition to their regular chores. I do not believe that you should pay kids for their regular chores. That's just their room and board for living there. I mean, you're feeding them, you're giving them clothes and shelter. They don't need paid for doing the dishes, for sweeping the floor, for helping with the laundry. That's just stuff that they should be doing anyway, or whatever you determine they should do. But I mean, pay them for additional jobs. So if there's something, I don't know what, you know, going and trimming a tree in the backyard and cleaning up all the brush from it, throwing it away, or something like that, just as an example, you pay them for additional work. You need the driveway repaved, you know, pay them for the additional work or whatever. You need the brakes changed on your car, and one of your kids is mechanically savvy. Maybe pay them a couple of bucks to do that or something. Then they get the incentive to work hard, because money is a great incentive. Money's not evil. The love of money is evil. But money is a good thing. And so that's a good way to incentivize your kids to work hard. Now, of course, if all these methods fail, you can always teach them with the rod, right? That's last result. You can always drive the laziness out of them with the rod. So here's the thing you want to remember. Make laziness more painful than labor, right? Make laziness more painful than labor, and they will work hard. Now, how does this prepare them for the real world? Well, no man or woman who doesn't have a strong work ethic is fit for the real world. So this is absolutely essential to preparing your kids for the real world. Here's another one I just thought I would throw in there, because I was just trying to think of everything that you might want to possibly teach your kids. And then, of course, we've all seen things in people out there that we think, well, you don't want to raise your kids like that. So you want to teach your kids good hygiene, because I don't know, you ever been around people's kids that stink? You know, like parents don't even care enough about them to give them a bath or something. I just thought I'd throw it out there. Of course, I know you all bathe your children, but I just figured I would put it in here just in case. There are going to be some kids that are going to be clean by nature, right? They're just going to like to be clean as they mature. And then there's going to be others that are going to need to be encouraged or forced to be. Some kids just hate being dirty at all, right? And then some kids, they could probably go a week or more without ever taking a bath. And I don't know why it is little kids don't like to take baths. Well, some of them do, but a lot of them don't. It's like late to a vampire or something. I don't know. You want to teach them to brush their teeth and floss daily? Like, I'm not teaching anything you don't know. I'm not trying to insult your intelligence. But just think about this. This will save them a lot of money and pain whenever they grow up. Brushing and flossing, and everybody forgets the flossing thing, but boy, the flossing thing will definitely save your teeth. And the thing is, if you let your kids be a little fast and loose with the brushing when they get the baby teeth, and then they get in a habit of that, when they get the adult teeth, you don't get another set every few years like the baby teeth, right? So you want to teach them to take care of them. I'm sorry, I got to keep apologizing. I feel like I am insulting your intelligence by telling you these things, but I think it's important enough to mention it. You can teach them that cleanliness is next to godliness. Now, that's actually not a verse, right? I think most people think that that's one of the verses in the Bible. You know, if you ask them for a verse in the Bible, cleanliness is next to godliness. It's not in the Bible, but the concept is, if you turn back to Leviticus 15, this is just one of many places that would give this to us. Leviticus 15, 5 through 8. God likes things clean. Leviticus 15, 5 through 8. And whosoever toucheth his bed shall wash his clothes and bathe himself in water and be unclean until the evening, even. And he that sitteth on anything whereupon he sat that hath the issue shall wash his clothes and bathe himself in water and be unclean until the even. And he that toucheth the flesh of him that hath the issue shall wash his clothes and bathe himself in water and be unclean until the even. How far did I say I was going to read? Down to verse 8. And he that hath the issue, and if he that hath the issue spit upon him that is clean, then he shall wash his clothes and bathe himself in water and be unclean until the even. So it's just one of many examples that God wants people washed and bathed and cleaned. So you want to teach kids to be clean and not go around smelling foully. Because if you think about it, especially boys, sometimes they don't have the best hygiene. What kind of a girl is going to want to go out on a date with you whenever you stink, right? And I know that some of you aren't into antiperspirants and deodorants and all that stuff. So if you're not using antiperspirant and deodorant, you probably want to bathe more often because you'll tend to stink. Maybe antiperspirants are bad for my health, and I'm sure that they are. But I guess I'm just willing to take the risk because I just don't like to sweat and smell, so I just use them. Anyway, I don't use them all the time, but I use them if I know I'm going to be sweating. And I don't know. If you have good reason why I shouldn't, I'd be glad to hear about that. I know it's got aluminum in it and all that, but anyway. Sin is described as filth in Scripture, and salvation from sin is oft described as cleansing or washing. So clearly, the Bible throughout promotes the idea of cleanliness. And a young man or woman who has poor personal hygiene is certainly not fit for the real world. If you go to get a real job and you stink when you go in for the interview, I am certain you are not going to get that job, right? So just basic information for you. All right, probably the last thing I'm going to cover today. Let me just take a look at the time. Yeah, definitely. I did not get as far as I thought I would. Last thing for today is you want to teach your children about puberty and sex whenever it's age appropriate. And you'll be able to figure that out when the time comes. Basically, when the questions come, you definitely know it's time, right? If they're asking questions about it and they're starting to get curious and they wonder where babies come from and that kind of thing, well, you definitely want to tell them. And don't tell them something stupid like make up some story about storks or whatever. Just tell them the truth. I'll tell you a funny story later. It's probably not appropriate for the pulpit. It's not a big deal, but anyway, I'll spare you. So before your children enter puberty, you want to let them know about the changes that are going to shortly begin in their bodies, especially the girls, right? Because you wouldn't want to not tell your girls that something major is going to happen here, and all of a sudden she starts bleeding, and she thinks she's dying or whatever. You want to tell them before puberty comes about what's going to happen. My mom got me a book, I don't remember what it was called, back when I was around that age, I think maybe puberty or just a little before. Maybe it was called What's Happening to My Body or something like that. And I found it really interesting just to read about all that and learn about all that. And as I was going through puberty, I could read about it and see what's happening. And I think that's a great idea. If you can find a good book on that, that's good. But talk to your kids about it. My mom probably did that because she didn't want to talk to me about it, right? But that was better than nothing. But talk to them. You don't want to let their friends give them sex education because they're going to learn all kinds of stuff you don't want them to know. Now, when they enter puberty and they begin to develop sexually, then you want to talk to them frankly and openly about sex. It shouldn't be a taboo subject. I mean, it's life, right? I mean, this is life. And if you don't talk to them about it, somebody else will. And that somebody else is probably not going to be somebody that you want to. I know it's uncomfortable, and I've never been there, but I can just imagine how awkward it is. But just do it. And just, I would just say, I personally just think, use the real words for the real terms and just tell them exactly what happens. And they're going to be grossed out or whatever. But just tell them about it. Just tell them exactly what happens and use the right terminology. You definitely don't want to fail in this extremely important area of child training. And I think that there are a lot of parents that fail in this area. My parents never talked to me about this stuff. And I think that's the case with a lot of parents. They just figure that they'll figure it out somewhere along the way. And that is not, that's not the way to go. That's not good. You want to let your kids know that, that they can talk to you about anything and encourage them to do so. I wish I would have had that with my parents. I never did. I just didn't. There were certain things that I just wouldn't feel comfortable with talking to my parents about. And I can thank my pastor, my former pastor, for that, because he was so open and you could talk to him about anything and no subject was taboo. And because of that, I've become a lot more open and I'm not afraid to talk about anything. Certain people I may be uncomfortable with just because they're uncomfortable. But in general, you can ask me about anything. You can talk to me about anything. I don't care. There's no question that you can't ask me that I won't talk to you frankly about. You want to teach your kids that sex must be reserved for marriage and that fornication is a grievous sin in the eyes of God. Look at Hebrews 13 and verse 4. Because this is one temptation that you know your children are going to have and they're going to fight with, and you want to instill this in them and make sure that they understand this. You don't want to be delinquent in this one. Because this particular sin has such grievous consequences to it. Just physical consequences, whether it's STDs or whether it's pregnancy out of wedlock, and then just all the emotional scarring and damage that goes along with it. And this is so, so important, and that's why I do mention it quite a bit from time to time. Hebrews 13 and verse 4, marriage is honorable in all, and the bed undefiled, but whoremongers and adulterers God will judge. So sex is only reserved for marriage. God will judge those who have sex outside of marriage, whether they're already married and they're having sex with somebody they're not married to, or whether they're not married yet at all. Either way, God will judge that. And some of those judgments are severe, physical judgments. And 1/4 of this population deals with it every day. STDs. It's a terrible thing. Look at 1 Corinthians 6, 18 through 20. 1 Corinthians 6, 18 through 20. I'll tell you what I think would be an effective thing to do with your kids is, and it's gross, but just get on the internet and search some of the STDs and show them pictures of that stuff. When I was in the Army, being in basic training is kind of like being a kid with parents telling you everything to do. And they put us through a sexual education thing because it's so prevalent, I think, and people in the Army are, I'm not characterizing completely or stereotyping, but they're pretty much reprobates, most of them, in my experience anyway. And so they told us about the STDs and they showed us pictures and all that because they didn't want that to happen. And I'd recommend doing that with your kids. That might scare the sin out of them. 1 Corinthians 6, 18 through 20. It says, flee fornication. Every sin that a man doeth is without the body, but he that committeth fornication sinneth against his own body. What, know ye not that your body is the temple of the Holy Ghost which is in you, which ye have of God, and ye are not your own? For ye are bought with a price, therefore glorify God in your body and in your spirit, which are God's. You see, there's something special about fornication. It says that every sin that a man doeth is without the body, but he that committeth fornication sinneth against his own body. I can't say that I fully have an explanation exactly what he means by that. I'll be quite honest with you. But there's something, I mean, you're using your body to sin, but you use your body to steal too. And I mean, there's other, you know, you kill somebody with your hands. I mean, I'm not exactly sure, but one thing that we do know for sure is there's something special about it. There's something special about it. And you want to flee it and stay away from it. And someday if I get a better explanation for that, then I'll be sure to tell you about it. And if you have one, you be sure to tell me about it. 1 Thessalonians 4, 3 through 7. 1 Thessalonians 4, 3 through 7. It says, for this is the will of God, even your sanctification, that ye should abstain from fornication, that every one of you should know how to possess his vessel, that is his body, in sanctification and honor, not in the lust of concupiscence as the Gentiles which know not God. You see, it's the Gentiles that are fornicators. People that don't know God are the fornicators. We are not supposed to be like that. Though we have the same temptations that they do, we are not supposed to give in to those. That no man go beyond and defraud his brother in any manner, because that the Lord is the avenger of all such, as we also have forewarned you and testified. For God hath not called us unto uncleanness, but unto holiness. He therefore that despiseth not man, but God, who hath also given unto us his Holy Spirit. You see, if the man of God, or if the parent, tells you not to fornicate and to possess your body in honor and to not defile yourself, and you despise that, you're not despising the man of God or the parent, you're despising God, because God is the one that tells us to do that. You want to warn your children about the power of sexual temptation. Now, when they're younger, they might not get that. Even when they first hit puberty, they might not totally get it. But the closer they get to their upper teens, they're going to know, they're going to understand it. And you want to give them the heads up and explain to them the feelings and the emotions and the drive that's going to be within them and how they need to control that. Proverbs 5, 9 through 20. And you want to explain to them, especially those of us who have been there, and we all that have hate it and hate ourselves for it, but those of us that have been there, you want to explain to them that when you are with your girlfriend and you get to a certain point, you cross, it's like crossing the Rubicon, you cross the point of no return, and it's just, you're not able to contain yourself and stop yourself. And you want to explain to them that you don't want to get to that point, that you want to keep yourself back from that edge, because when you get to a certain point, it's over. Proverbs 5, 19 through 20. And I'm being vague intentionally, but you know what I'm talking about. You know what I'm talking about, and you explain it to your kids. Proverbs 5, 19 through 20. Let her be as the loving hind and pleasant roe. Let her breast satisfy thee at all times. Talking about the man's wife. And be thou ravished always with her love. And why wilt thou, my son, be ravished with a strange woman and embrace the bosom of a stranger? You see, it's fine to be ravished by your own wife. To be ravished means to be carried away by force, violated, ravished. So if you are ravished, you're carried away. It's if by force. Now, of course, that could be rape, but it doesn't have to be rape. It could be you're just literally, there's a force pulling you that you can't withstand, right? It's called sexual temptation. It's called sexual lust. In marriage, it's a great thing. Nothing wrong with it whatsoever. But outside of marriage, it's a very bad thing. Have you ever heard two young people that went too far? What do they say? We got carried away, right? It's perfectly scriptural. They did get carried away. They got ravished, right? It was too tempting. It was too strong. They could not hold themselves back. Now, somebody told a story one time, and I think this is a good example, that when I say you can't hold yourself back, you can, but a lot of people, most people, just don't have the willpower to do it. Somebody gave an example one time, though. They said, what if you're with your girlfriend, you're on the couch and nobody's home, and things are getting a little carried away, and you're to the point of no return, and all of a sudden, busts in the door her 6'5" dad, great big bulky guy. You're going to stop right there, right then, right? So you can stop. It is possible to stop, but most people don't have the willpower to do it, and you don't want to play. That's fire that you don't want to play with. You don't want to play with that, and you want to teach your kids that. Proverbs 6, 25 through 26. Talking about the strange woman. Lust not after her beauty in thine heart, neither let her take thee with her eyelids. For by means of a whorish woman, a man is brought to a piece of bread, and the adulteress will hunt for the precious life. Teach your boys especially, because boys are going to have more trouble with this than girls. And you teach them that there are bad, evil women out there that will try to seduce him, but chances are he's going to be the one that's doing the seducing, and you want to teach him not to be the strange man and not to get tangled up with a strange woman. Because by means of a whorish woman, a man will be brought to a piece of bread. You ever heard of alimony? A man will be brought to a piece of bread. There have been men that have been brought to financial ruin because of being carried away with lust towards a strange woman that they weren't married to. Lose half everything they own and then lose the majority of their, or a good chunk of their paycheck for the rest of their life. Then Proverbs 7, verses 10 through 27. I don't think I'm going to read this whole passage. You've read this passage before, no doubt, about the strange woman. And you can see her tactics. You can see what she does. And you know what? I will read it. Why not? I'll just read it. Proverbs 7, 10 through 27. It says, "And behold, there met him a woman with the attire of an harlot and subtle of heart." You got to watch out for those ones that are dressed like sluts. "She is loud and stubborn, her feet abide not in her house. Now is she without, now in the streets, and lieth in wait at every corner. So she caught him and kissed him, and with an impudent face said unto him, I have peace offerings with me. This day have I paid my vows." You got to watch out for that woman that is forward. Watch out for that woman you're on a date with, and she makes the first move to give you the first kiss or something. You don't want to date a woman like that, especially if she starts talking about being a Christian. "Oh, where do you go to church?" "Oh, I go to church too. I'm a Christian." "So she's got peace offerings with me. This day have I paid my vows. I just went to church." And then she's making a move on you. You got to watch out for a woman like that. "Therefore came I forth to meet thee diligently to seek thy face, and I have found thee. Beware of the woman that's flattering you." "Oh, I've been looking for somebody just like you. You're just so perfect. Everything about you is so wonderful." Watch out for a woman like that. "I've decked my bed with coverings of tapestry, with carved works, with fine linen of Egypt." You're dating a woman, she starts talking about her bed, it's time to leave. Right? That's a bad woman when she starts talking about her bedroom. "Oh, come and look at the way I've decorated up my bedroom." No. Time to turn and run. You go to your girlfriend's house, you stay out of the bedroom. You don't need to see how her bedroom's decorated up. You can see how her bedroom's decorated up after you get married. "I have perfumed my bed with myrrh, aloes, and cinnamon. Come, let us take our fill of love until the morning. Let us solace ourselves with loves. For the good man is not at home. He has gone a long journey." Now, if everything else wasn't a red flag, when she says, "My husband's not at home. He's gone on a business trip. He's taking a big sack of cash with him. And he'll come back at the day appointed, but he's not going to be back for a while." If the other stuff wasn't enough, that should be enough to say, you know what? This is not a good woman. I don't want to be involved with this woman. He hath taken a bag of money with him and will come home at the day appointed. With her much fair speech, she caused him to yield. With the flattering of her lips, she forced him. You see, women can rape men too, right? I mean, they could physically do it, but they don't have to physically do it. A strange woman that knows what she's doing, a truly wicked woman, could easily force a man just by these type of tactics, by flattering him, by provocative speech, by certain looks, of course, just flat out attacking him. I mean, a woman could easily force a man without actually physically forcing him to do something. It's very different how men and women operate. "He goeth after her straightway as an ox goeth to the slaughter, or as a fool to the correction of the stocks." You see, he's so stupid, he doesn't realize that what he's doing is going to be his own demise. "Till a dart strike through his liver, as a bird hasteth to the snare, and knoweth not that it is for his life. Hearken unto me now, therefore, O ye children, and attend to the words of my mouth. Let not thine heart decline to her ways, and go not astray in her paths. For she hath cast down many wounded. Yea, many strong men have been slain by her." You want to explain to your boys that Samson was one of the strongest men that ever lived, and he was taken down by a woman. You want to tell him that Solomon was the wisest man that ever lived, save the Lord Jesus Christ, and outlandish women caused him to sin. You want to tell them that Adam was the most sinless human being that ever lived, save the Lord Jesus Christ. They were both sinless. Adam was sinless and was brought down by a woman. You want to tell him that women have incredible power over men. "Her house is the way to hell, going down to the chambers of death." I would recommend reading this chapter, really reading Proverbs 5, 6, and 7 to your boys whenever they get to be of past puberty, or whenever they get into puberty. Read these chapters to them and expound them like I just did, and go through them and show them the tactics of the strange woman and remind them of these things every so often. Because they want to have firm principles before they start dating. You want to warn them of the prevalence of sexually transmitted diseases, STDs, and how they can destroy their lives. This will be the last verse I'll give you. Proverbs 5 and verse 11. He's warning him of the dangers of the strange woman. And he says in verse 8, "Remove thy way far from her, and come not nigh the door of her house, lest thou give thine honor unto others, and thy years unto the cruel, lest strangers be filled with thy wealth, and thy labors be in the house of a stranger." That's called alimony. "And thou mourn at the last when thy flesh and thy body are consumed." That's called an STD. You know what the Bible refers to the male privy member as a lot of times? His flesh. His flesh, "lest thy flesh and thy body be consumed." Think about that. I don't know if there were STDs back then or not. Might have been, could have been, probably were. I think we have a lot more today. And I don't think it's a coincidence that we had a sexual revolution in the 60s and an explosion of STDs and new STDs and all kinds of horrible stuff. I don't think that's a coincidence whatsoever. I think that God sent those things to judge a wicked, adulterous, fornicating nation. Amen. You want to warn your kids about those things, because some of them can be treated with antibiotics and go away. Some of them last a lifetime. Some of them have debilitating mental and physical effects. Some of them will flat out kill you. And they won't, unfortunately, they don't kill you right away. They kill you with a nice, long, slow, painful death. You don't want your kids to fall into that. And you also want to warn them that having children out of wedlock has the potential to ruin both their and their children's lives. The potential. There have been plenty of people that messed up and then got married and things are great, you know. But it does have the potential. You could really wreck your life, especially if you're with the wrong person. You're with some whore for a one-night stand, you get her pregnant or something, then you're really screwed. So you want to be really careful about that. And just, like I said, this is such an important topic. This sexual one in particular has the potential to really wreck your kids' lives. And if you're going to be good on anything, I would say be good on this one, because this is very, very important. So next time we're going to pick up with spiritual development. And this truly will have something in it for everybody. So this stuff will be just as applicable to every single one of you, no matter what your age is. It's got nothing to do with having kids or not. So thank you for your kind and patient attention today.